Jason could barely stand in the wake of Neil's spell wearing off, but he determinedly pushed himself to his feet.
"We need to move with alacrity," Shade said. "The cult's forces approach."
Jason nodded, pausing only to spare what was left of Anissa a brief glance. He was again reminded that most of the people he had first met on arriving in this world were dead. Most of the Vane family, their servants, Farah, and now Anissa. For all the wonders his new home offered, it took its price in horrors, and Jason was unsure whether or not he had become one of them.
"Shade, grab her dimensional bag and mount up."
The possessions of the Archbishop had automatically been looted by Jason's power when his execute ability completely annihilated him. Looting powers could extricate goods from personal dimensional spaces, although Jason didn't stop to check what he had taken. The team left the ruined building behind. Shade had taken the form of some large lizards, well-suited to navigating the terrain. Sophie and Clive had already helped Belinda onto the back of Onslow. Having taken a spirit coin, she was in worse shape than Jason and Humphrey. Jason and Neil rode Shade out, Humphrey rode Stash, while Sophie easily kept pace on foot. They didn't stop for hours, making sure to get well clear of the site of their battle. Once they were confident there was no one trailing them, rest became the next order of business. Jason pulled out the cloud house inside a building they found with an internal space large enough to contain it. It was a church, although not to a god any of them recognized. Any lingering divine aura the building might have once hosted had long ago faded away. Sophie took watch, keeping an eye out for cultist scouts. Humphrey, Jason, and Belinda retreated into the house to recuperate. Damage from neither spirit coin usage nor Neil's spell could be rushed through recovery using magic. They quickly fell asleep in the comforting embrace of cloud chairs, while Neil kept an eye on their conditions. Before collapsing, Jason had divested himself of everything his looting power had plucked from the Archbishop's personal storage space. Clive went over it, along with the contents of Anissa's dimensional bag. There was a very large number of potions and a startling amount of money. Hendren, it seemed, had taken a large chunk of the Church of Purity's coffers with him on sabbatical. Those things he put aside, in favour of a good-sized collection of documents and a very full bookcase.
"It's mostly correspondence from higher-ups in the church," Clive said to Neil, going through the documents.
He had taken a quick peruse of all the items and was now taking a closer look at the documents.
"Anything useful?" Neil asked.
"I'm not sure how much of it will be of use to us," Clive said. "The Adventure Society will definitely want to get their hands on these, though. There is correspondence here with explicit statements about the agreement between the church and the cult."
"Anything about why the Church of Purity would throw in with these people?" Neil asked.
"Not at a glance," Clive said. "It'll take me a while to go through it all properly. It does seem that the ones siding with the cult are only a fraction of the church, though."
"That makes sense," Neil said. "If the whole church knew, there's no way they could have kept it a secret."
"There also seems to have been a concern that a lot of the church members would not be accepting of the arrangement."
"You mean they thought priests who literally worship purity wouldn't be accommodating to a cult that fills people's bodies and souls with evil magic junk?" "That was probably a good assessment."
"I have to think that most of purity's worshippers aren't secretly evil," Clive said.
"I suspect Jason would disagree."
"Well, Jason has his biases," Clive said. "He comes from a world where the gods apparently don't show themselves at all, and let the people wage wars over the truth. Then he comes here, and the first clergy person he meets is that priestess we just killed. She wasn't exactly a good ambassador for the virtues of faith."
"Then it turns out an ostensibly good church is in league with an evil cult," Neil said. "You can see why he might end up wary of the whole thing."
"Even the Purity Church members who are in on it clearly don't like the people they're allied with," Clive said, gesturing absently with a sheet of paper. "This is a letter to Hendren, more or less telling him to put up with it and do what he's told. While the faction working with the cult certainly believe they have their god on their side, they seem very unhappy with the alliance. It seems the cult had to pressure the church into coming along on this expedition at all."
I would have been happy for them to stay at home, Neil said. I imagine they would be too, now their leader's been dissolved into nothing.
Neil glanced warily over at the sleeping Jason. Does Asano ever scare you at all? He asked quietly. Most of the time he seems ridiculous, but sometimes he really, really doesn't. When he just walked into that town and killed all those bandits, the way he looked at them, like they were nothing.
Jason is good at being what he needs to be, in order to do what he needs to do,
Clive said, likewise speaking softly.
Sometimes what he needs to do is kill a lot of people. And yes, seeing what he becomes to do that does scare me a little.
Hopefully it scares the Builder too. From the Builder's perspective, pulling in the church for this must seem like a waste now. He brought along an extra silver ranker who didn't accomplish anything but die.
Their rush to put us down cost them one of their most powerful people, Clive said. Whatever else, we can be certain that the Builder isn't happy.
This has worked out very well, the Builder said. Losing Hendren's power is a blow, obviously, but he was a reluctant ally at best.
You want to step up the kind of procedure we use on his people?
Zato said.
Precisely, the Builder agreed. Now that the church's leadership here is dead, there is little concern about any survivors reporting to their god when we are done here. We no longer have to take half measures in converting the clergyman to protect Hendren's sensibilities.
There are other bronze rankers in their number, Zato said.
None who held a leadership position like LaSalle. That they died together helps us more than either of them surviving. None of the remaining clergy will be able to pull the rest together and effectively resist our intentions. Take them into custody, and prepare the iron rankers for immediate conversion.
What do we do with their bronze rankers? Zato asked. We can't convert them with clockwork cores we get from sacrificing our iron rankers.
That is a question, the Builder said.
The failure to summon the Clockwork King and the cores it could produce truly was the beginning of things going wrong with your operations. If your former superiors had the ability to adapt to circumstances you have demonstrated, we would be in a better position right now. You have demonstrated a talent for making the most of what you are given. What do you suggest?
Zato rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
We could prepare them for use as additional vessels, but that would take too long. Maybe.
Zato's gaze lingered on the ruined body of the Builder's withered husk of a body.
You're about to abandon that vessel, Zato said. You have instructed me to see it destroyed, but perhaps we can put it to a better use.
Explain, the Builder said.
We feed it the bronze rank clergyman, fatten it up, then send it after the Rejector and his people. An energy vampire gets little from feeding on monsters and will go hunting for richer meals. It may well be able to sniff out the souls of our enemies. We can make it our hunting hound, flushing them into the open, or even killing them outright. It might not work, but what does it cost us to try? A spent vessel, and some priests we would probably have to execute anyway.
Your proposal has merit, the Builder said. An energy vampire will have no interest in our people. The soul and body modifications you have undergone make you unpalatable to them. If we are going to convert all the clergy, or feed them to the vampire directly, then it will have no more interest in us.
The Builder nodded, dry skin flaking off its face at the gesture.
Very well, the Builder said. Seize the clergy, prepare the iron rankers for conversion, and collar the bronze rankers. Prepare a binding circle to hold the vessel once I am done with it, and we shall conduct the vessel exchange. Afterward, we can begin the conversions.
The more thorough conversions than we originally intended will add to the time required, Zato said.
It will better prepare us for the next step, however. We have to assume that once we start sending teams out, the rejector will try and intervene.
Let him, the builder said. His rejection of the star seed may have inured him to further implantation, but his companions enjoy no such immunity. I will take them, one by one, and he will watch. Once that is done, they will be the ones to kill him.
How many potions can one person carry? Belinda asked, looking at them all stacked up. We didn't bring in this many for six people over a series of months.
These are iron, bronze, and silver rank, Jason said. This is probably the supply for his whole contingent. The team was going through what they had taken from the Archbishop. His most important gear had been on his body and destroyed along with it, but looting his personal storage space had still yielded a slew of valuables. Since they were already going over loot, it seemed like a good chance to tally their collected loot from months of monster hunting, which they added to the pile. They had a lot of materials that would be valuable for crafting. At an earlier stage, they had purged their stocks of the iron rank materials to make room for bronze and silver. They also had what had become a huge stockpile of monster cores on top of the essences and awakening stones picked up along the way. Fully functioning magic items were produced by Neil and Jason's looting powers far less frequently than materials. The rarity of such items was mostly low, although the silver rank monsters they fought had produced a few items that were more impressive. They were all silver rank, so not yet of any use to the team. One item in particular stood out amongst the others.
Item: Orb of Ascension. Silver. Silver rank. Legendary. An orb containing the most precious power of all.
Potential.
Consumable. Magic core.
Effect:
A single epic or legendary quality bronze rank item gains the ability to be increased in rank through a ritual of ascension. Additional material requirements vary based on the affected item. A few of the bronze rank items had been claimed by the team. Jason had replaced his iron rank boots with a pair of black boots taken from an insectoid monster called a nighthopper. The new boots were higher rank but lower rarity than his existing boots, lacking the whip blade function that Jason had used only occasionally but always effectively. As they moved on to bronze and silver rank monsters, the iron rank boots had become increasingly battered. Without the self-repair function of his main armor, the boots had become so ragged that he feared they would be too damaged and lose the enchantment. The new boots also lacked self-repair, but were very sturdy, even for a bronze rank item. Most importantly, they replicated the most important functions of his old boots. The jumping power was even stronger than on his old boots, which had become a critical part of how he moved around. Added to his heightened bronze rank attributes, the new boots gave him more of exactly what he wanted. It was the final trait that was the true reason he made the switch, and without it, he would never have picked the new footwear. They color coordinated with his armor. Belinda had done the best out of the entire team, largely because she could use such a wide array of gear. Her various abilities that replicated different roles each needed their own gear set to have full effect. This was especially true, given she would never match up to a specialist in any given area with her stopgap powers. She had purchased a variety of bare-bones equipment sets before they left, picked out with the aid of Gary's expert eye. She had sacrificed everything else at the altar of cost-effectiveness, giving her what Jason described as a quest-reward hodgepodge look. This was only exacerbated as she added items looted from their opponents, but the results had been worth the effort. She might look a bit unprofessional in her eclectic outfits, but her ability to be exactly what the team needed was stronger than ever. The builder's walled encampment was filled with screams. You did an impressive job, arranging for so many to be converted at once with the available space, the builder said.
Thank you, Lord, Timos said. I know that you like efficiency. I managed to create enough stations that all of our ritualists can be working simultaneously. It's grisly, but hardly the first place we've painted with blood. things are moving quickly because this is their field of expertise, Zato said. Our problems have all come from their needing to take on the astral magic duties after Landemir Vane was killed. That was a grave disappointment, Timos said. I'd been cultivating him for years. I was quite pleased with how he'd turned out.
There is more astral magic to be done, the builder said. Now I am here to direct things personally, however. All that is required is that they follow direction.
That's much I can assure you they are capable of, Zato said. I made quite certain of that.
The next obstacle is the altered state of the ambient magic, the builder said. Naturally, I have the knowledge to compensate in activating the gates, but this vessel isn't powerful enough to open portals and transport our people around the astral space.
Once the conversions are complete, we will be able to put together teams strong enough to navigate the dangers outside the walls. The need to physically travel to each location instead of just portaling is logistically more involved, but ultimately, all it will cost us is time and a few casualties to monsters.
And the Rejector, Timos added. His team are coordinated and fearless. I escaped immediately, and it was still enough time to see that. They are also powerful enough to deal with Hendren. Only the best bronze rank teams could have done that. Timos was still shaken by his encounter with Jason's team. Jason's spell that landed as Timos was fleeing had burned a symbol into Timos's face that the builder had identified as the word Sin, from a symbolic language older than their world. The builder had to remove the curses before the light, but Prominent Mark would heal.
We will lose people to the Rejector, the builder said. But we hold the advantage. We still have the strength and we still have the numbers, while they do not have the luxury of staying hidden. They will be forced to climb out of their hole if they intend to understand what we are doing, let alone attempt to stop us.
Chapter 61. A Significantly More Dangerous Entity. The builder was now wearing Thadwick's face, but those that knew him would spot the difference immediately. There was a very different beast inside Thadwick's body, and the change was startling. It began in the eyes, hard and unyielding. This was a gaze that knew its domain was everything it landed upon. Person, place, or object, all that it saw, it owned. It was a far cry from the insecure haughtiness of the body's former owner and his constant need for validation. Uncertain arrogance had been replaced with world-shaking confidence, transforming his entire demeanor. From facial expression to posture, Thadwick's body exuded the domineering presence that had ever been his unrealized intention. The builder walked alongside Zato and Timos as they inspected their new weapons, lined up like soldiers on parade. The former clergy stood with blank expressions, their personalities wiped clean. The souls inside were screaming, but only the builder could hear them. He was no more moved by their suffering than was the brick under their feet. Their clothes, torn and bloody from the involuntary procedure, had been replaced with plain garments. Around a third of them had grey-coloured clothes, the rest had brown. Their original clothes were gone, but their skin was still coated with the rust of dried blood. The cultists hadn't bothered to wash them off following the gruesome conversion process. To ordinary senses, the converted seemed normal, aside from the empty, blank expressions. To magic and aura senses, they were anything but normal. There was no longer any trace of essence power within their auras, all burned as fuel for the magic intricately engraved all across their skeletons with the fine precision of circuitry. So stark was the power coursing over and through their bones that magical senses could clearly feel it, radiating through their flesh. The magic felt alien, unnatural, and artificial, surging around their bodies and through the clockwork core implanted in their hearts. The cores were a modified variant of the cores used to create constructs, and were regulating the magic of the converted. To aura senses, the converted projected a uniform, blank, and sterile bronze rank aura, coming from what had once been iron rank essence users. It was stronger from the brown-garbed individuals than those in grey, but in both cases the auras being generated were firm and unfluctuating. Most disturbing was that the auras were identical amongst all those standing in line. The unique signature that was an intrinsic trait of all auras was unsettlingly absent. There was no trace of their individuality or the suffering they were experiencing in the deepest reaches of their souls. The procedure of emplacing the engravings had been painstaking and gruesome, carving them onto the skeleton directly and by hand. Flesh was peeled back and the engravings made, bone by bone, before the flesh was returned. Only the massively accelerated healing bestowed by the procedure made it possible for the subject to survive. Even then, moving on to the deeper bones that required more extreme procedures to access was a delicate balance. It began with the least invasive areas, moving on to the more critical areas as more of the procedure was completed. By the time the ritualists were going for the hips, pelvis, and spine, they had already walked a precarious balancing act to keep the subject alive at all. Paralysis magic was key in preventing any disruptive movement or screaming. "Many of them had divine essences," Timos said. "That power was not consumed by the process, but returned to their god. So those ones are somewhat weaker. I've given the weaker ones grey garments and the stronger ones brown to easily identify each group. My concern is that purity will know the reason for this sudden return of power." "The god's eyes do not extend to this place," the builder assured him. "All purity will know is that his people died in rapid succession. There are dangers in this place that are plausible enough explanation. He will suspect, but not risk the alliance by pushing the issue. Show me the difference between the stronger and the lesser." Timos nodded at a pair of cultists standing by, who stepped forward. They moved up to two of the converted, one brown-garbed and one in grey. Each cultist drew a long knife and sliced open the throat of the converted in front of them, blood spraying from the wounds. The converted showed no reaction, and the gaping slashes quickly closed, with that of the brown-wearing converted happening faster than the other. It only took seconds for the savagely slashed throats to completely heal over, marked only by the blood that had spilled out. "Adequate," the builder said. "Did we lose any in the conversion process?" "We did not," Timos said. "The ritualists were fastidious in their work."
"Good. Having a vessel present gives me the ability to control them directly. But I cannot share their perceptions the way I can with those carrying star seeds. Begin organizing them into teams with our people and the constructs. We begin the next stage in the morning. Now, show me my previous vessel."
The team, now fully recovered, were discussing their next move.
"We need more information," Humphrey said. "Did you get anything from what we took from Hendron, Clive?"
"No. Insofar as I can tell, Hendron thought that this was just another astral space the Builder was trying to steal. There's nothing about those giant golems or what the Builder might want with them."
"When I was scouting their camp using Shade's body, they looked to be gearing up to set out from their walled-off fort," Jason said. "Whatever they're doing, they can't do it from where they are."
"They probably need to go to the towers around the city, right?" Belinda said. "They have to be doing something with those world engineer things. Are they going to wake them up?"
"If they are," Clive said, "I have to wonder what does the Builder get out of that? Right now they're locked away in this astral space."
"Their diamond rank," Neil said. "For all we know, they're powerful enough to leave this astral space using their own abilities."
"I didn't think of that," Clive said. "You could well be right. The little I've learned about diamond rank has a recurring theme of the old rules no longer applying."
"Maybe he isn't looking to wake them up," Belinda said. "Those towers are the anchor points tethering this astral space to our world, right? The portals linking it to our world are integrated right into them. What if their real purpose is some kind of delivery system? Rather than wake them up, he's trying to move them into our world."
"Whether they're moving on their own steam or getting a push along,
a dozen diamond-ranked supergolems is not what we want floating about, Jason said. We may not know what they do, but with a name like World Engineers, I think we really need to stop them from doing it.
Then what's our next move?
Sophie asked. I hate to be passive, given what's potentially at stake, Jason said. I don't think we can just stage an attack on their fort, though. They have another silver ranker, a small army of priests and cultists, and however many of those construct creatures they've built. They also have the builder itself. Do we have any idea how much power it has, or what it can do with that power? And by we, I of course mean Clive.
I don't know, Clive said. Those walls it built are an impressive edifice, but you said its vessel looked more dead than alive. Most likely, that strained the vessel it's occupying. You said you were sensing silver rank magic from it.
Yes, although I couldn't sense it at all until it was standing right in front of me. It seemed like silver rank magic holding the body together, but I have no idea if that's its limit.
Most likely, Clive said. A more powerful vessel would require a more powerful sacrifice, and they don't have a silver ranker they can just toss away for that.
I think we can all agree that a preemptive attack would be ill-advised, Humphrey said.
You're counseling patience. Yes, Jason said. We watch and we wait. When they make a move, we look for a chance to dig out what they're doing. Once we know what they're up to, and hopefully how, we can start figuring out how to stop it.
Does that mean we start hanging around outside of the fort, waiting for them to come out? Neil asked.
I've already sent Shade to do exactly that, Jason said. He'll be keeping a good distance because we can't be sure how sensitive the builder's senses are, but he'll spot it if they make any big moves.
Zato, Timos, and the builder walked past the array of construct creatures, most of which had been completed. Under normal circumstances, creating such creatures was a laborious and magic-intensive process. Access to clockwork cores made their construction cheap and relatively easy for those with the expertise to use them. For the cult ritualists who specialized in their use, it was simplicity itself. Clockwork core constructs were a cheap and dirty version of regular construct creatures. Those crafted through the usual process were a superior product, but the requirements in materials, time, and facilities were considerable. The ability to quickly produce large numbers of constructs in the field, with no need for specialist workshops, made clockwork core constructs more valuable than those that were, rank for rank, more powerful. The only drawback to this approach was securing a supply of the clockwork cores. Without a clockwork king to produce more, the cultists were running increasingly short. The battles in the desert astral space and on their island base had cost them a vast number of the constructs, both destroyed outright and abandoned in the need to go to ground. The constructs they assembled now were consuming the last of their cores. Even the builder itself was unable to produce new ones with its current vessel, as it was not strong enough to endure the power it would take to create more. Zato led the others past the constructs, to where the builder's previous vessel was in a cage made of magically shaped stone. The cage was surrounded by an active magic circle, glowing with purple light. The vessel was visibly healthier than it had been while possessed by the builder, and while it was far from looking flush with life, it no longer had the appearance of a weeks-old corpse. The reason for its recovery was not just the absence of the builder's power eating it away from the inside, but also the dead bronze rank priests piled up in the cage. It had fed on them all for the sustenance it needed to survive. Feeding, however, had not let it move beyond the animalistic instincts it had been left with on the builder's departure for a new shell. The intelligence of the man it had once been was nowhere in evidence. Crouched in the cage, it stared at them warily.
What exactly does it feed on? Timos asked. My understanding is that the soul is inviolable. I cannot imagine this feral creature having the skill of you, Lord, at forcing people to yield that barrier.
While it is commonly accredited as feeding on the soul, that is not what energy vampires do, the builder explained.
They are also, strictly speaking, not vampires. They are more akin to ghouls, wretched things that know nothing but hunger. They do attack the soul, which disrupts the magical matrix that governs the physical body, and they feed on this disturbed magic. It can't truly feed on souls, then, Timos said. It could, if given the chance. When such a creature does find a way to feed on a soul, that power is transformative. The ghoul truly does become a form of vampire, a significantly more dangerous entity. Such chances are rare, however. And it won't go after monsters? Timos said. No, the builder confirmed. It requires a true soul to trigger a reaction that disrupts the body's flow of magic. The false souls of monsters barely react to such attacks, making them poor sustenance. So it won't go after the monsters, Zato said. But what of the twisted flesh creatures that inhabit this astral space? Are their souls damaged enough for the ghoul to ignore them? There were hundreds of them, according to our agents in the Adventure Society, Timos said. One of the last reports before our people had to withdraw from their positions was that the Rejector intended to wipe the flesh creatures out. They have likely thinned out the numbers in their time here, Zato said. I can't imagine they eliminated them all, under the conditions here. But hopefully there are few enough left that it isn't an issue, and the ghoul seeks out the Rejector. Souls that have been significantly altered create an unusual reaction in the body's magic, which taints it to such ghouls, the builder said. It is the same reason it might attack you, but cannot feed off of you. The alterations I have made to your soul make you poisonous to it. The flesh creatures are similar, and it will not go after them. The ghoul should go right for the Rejector then, once it catches wind of him, Zato said. Yes. The flesh creatures will not be a concern, the builder said. What will be a concern to us are the Vorgia that created the flesh creatures in the first place. They would not be so foolish as to come anywhere near me, but once our teams move out, the Vorgia will move in on them. I'll make sure that each team contains people capable of handling incorporeal pests, Timos said. Good, Zato said. Lord, do you wish to release this energy ghoul now? Yes, the builder said. I shall have our ritualists securely remove it from the fort. No need, the builder said. I shall deal with it myself. The builder strode through the magic circle, which flickered and dimmed as it passed over it. Nearing the cage, the magically molded bars started to run like mud, quickly thinning to an almost watery consistency and splashing onto the brickwork, where it immediately hardened again. The ghoul leapt at the builder, who snatched it out of the air with one hand, clasping its fingers around the ghoul's neck. The ghoul collapsed in his grip, falling limp like a rag. The builder then carried it to the nearest gate in the wall, which opened at his approach. The builder tossed out the ghoul, which regained its senses in the air, twisting into an animalistic catfall. It looked back, fearfully, before scrambling away, still on all fours. The builder raised a hand and dust rose from the ground, swirling together into a small but solid shape. It was a crystal eyeball with spider legs that, immediately on being completed, scurried off after the ghoul. Chapter 62. Losing the Battle to Win the War. Jason dashed forward, his sword flicking out. Faster, Sophie said, catching every strike with her hand as she moved backwards, easily matching the pace of Jason's advance. You don't need to hit hard, she said. If you're going to fight the constructs effectively, it's about building up the power on your sword as quickly as possible. Fending off Jason's attacks while moving backwards at speed was apparently not strenuous enough to make her incapable of carrying on conversation. They had chosen rough terrain on purpose, with undergrowth, vines, and plants growing up through displaced brickwork. Her perception power, the only one on the team yet to receive magical senses, gave her an advanced form of spatial awareness. Each member of the team experienced a similar gain in spatial awareness just from their senses advancing to bronze, but hers was an order of magnitude greater. It was the difference between navigating a well-known room in the dark and moving through it with the lights on. More than just navigating whatever space she happened to occupy, Sophie's senses made her far better at reading the attacks of enemies. She could track the movements of everyone around her, intercepting attacks she could feel even if she couldn't see them. Jason had experienced a surge in his combat skills between his bronze rank attributes and the new Way of the Reaper techniques that made the most of them. For Sophie, though, reaching bronze rank was putting wings on a tiger. Like Humphrey, her combat skills were the platform on which her entire power set was balanced, and being stronger, faster, and more aware of her surroundings were acting as force multipliers to her capabilities. For Jason's power set, by comparison, strategic movement was more critical than combat technique. Being in the right place at the right time was the most important factor in making the most of his abilities, and the balance of his training reflected that. Since many of those powers would be ineffective against the cult's constructs, however, he would be reliant on his sword. For that reason, Humphrey and Sophie were taking turns helping him hone his swordsmanship. As with most things, Jason's approach to swordsmanship was slightly off-kilter to most people. As with his knife-fighting style, quantity of hits was more important than quality. He didn't need powerful strikes, but frequent ones, to build up the power on his sword. He did actually need to land hits, not just harmless taps, but even the least effective blow would get the job done, so long as it was effective at all. With the bronze rank advancement, the sword would not just build up charges with each hit. It would also leave behind ongoing damage effects, bringing it more into line with Jason's normal style, although not as effectively as his normal powers. While that meant diminished capability, Jason was quietly relieved that his entire worth couldn't be replicated by a single, albeit impressive, magic item.
"Mr. Asano," Shade said, emerging from Jason's shadow. Jason and Sophie brought their practice to a stop.
"There's been some activity?" Jason asked.
"It would seem that the builder has moved to its new vessel," Shade said. "Unexpectedly, it did not kill off the previous one, but threw it out of the fortress immediately."
Jason and Sophie had been practicing just outside the church building containing the Cloud House. As Shade talked, they made their way back inside to meet with the team. "The builder's vessel survived having the builder in it?" Jason asked.
"It's a little more complicated than that," Shade said.
"Well, wait on an explanation until we meet up with the team," Jason said. It was not long before the team was gathered in the lounge room of the Cloud House.
"What are we dealing with?" Humphrey asked.
"The builder's previous vessel," Shade said. "The builder's new one, the former Mr. Mercer, cast it out of the fortified camp in person."
"What kind of state is it in?" Jason asked. "I didn't think it would survive."
"It won't have, strictly speaking," Clive explained. "It'll be an energy ghoul now, an undead thing, only kept animate by residual magic. Little, if any, of the original mind will be intact."
"It was acting in a very animalistic manner," Shade said.
"The magic sustaining it won't last long," Clive said. "It will need more to avoid going from undead to just plain dead."
"What kind of magic?" Belinda asked.
"The kind flowing through all of us," Clive said. "We've discussed in the past about how the bodies of anyone, iron rank or higher, move closer and closer to a genetic magical substance that it shapes as needed. The magic involved in that process is governed by the soul. An energy ghoul feeds by disrupting that magic with a soul attack, then consuming it."
"Why did the builder throw this thing out instead of just putting it down?" Jason asked. "Won't it be a threat to their people?"
"The cultists all have souls poisoned by their star seeds," Clive said. "The Purity Church people will be vulnerable to it, however."
"Which the cult may not care about, now the leader of the church contingent is dead," Humphrey said.
The builder may not care about what they have to contribute, now they aren't providing a silver ranker.
I believe that we can surmise the church's contribution, Shade said. The former vessel was in an improved condition compared to when Mr. Asano and myself met with the builder.
He's been feeding the church people to it? Jason asked. That's a bad ally to have.
A great astral being is one of the few that do not need fear a god's retribution, Clive said. The gods of our world can't see into this astral space because it isn't part of our world. So long as none of Purity's people come back alive, the builder can just blame all the deaths on us.
I'm happy to do my part, Sophie said. I'll kill them all with a smile on my face.
Sophie, Belinda scolded. Since when do you smile?
The team stifled laughs at Sophie's affronted expression. Let's keep on topic, Humphrey said, despite the poor job he was doing of schooling amusement from his own face. How dangerous is this thing?
Was it a silver rank aura? Clive asked Shade.
Yes, Shade said. Its aura is unstable, but quite violent.
And that's the real threat, Clive said. The physical danger it poses is relatively small, akin to an ordinary silver rank monster. No additional powers, not even claws, just the silver rank attributes.
Relatively small, Jason said. You haven't gone toe-to-toe with a silver rank monster. Just the attributes are plenty dangerous enough.
But not something beyond your ability to handle alone, Clive said, which is the important thing. If it can suppress our auras, it will launch a soul attack. We've seen the results of that, courtesy of you, Jason. We can most likely withstand it, but you're the only one of us likely to hold up well enough to remain combat effective. The rest will have to focus on maintaining our aura integrity.
That puts it all on Jason, Humphrey said. Are you up for that?
I'll have to be, Jason said.
I still don't understand what the builder is looking to accomplish in feeding this thing up and sending it off. What does he get from doing that?
An energy ghoul is incredibly sensitive to the life and soul magic. It also ignores monsters because it can't feed on them effectively.
He wants to use it to find us, Sophie said.
That seems likely, Clive said. It's not a bad idea either. It probably won't even take that long to find us. Its movements will be erratic until it catches our trail. Not an actual trail, but a sense of our magic. Once it does, it'll make a beeline right for us.
I have one of my bodies following it, Shade said. It is making a straight line, but not in our direction. I think Mr. Standish may be incorrect in counting the soul attack as the largest danger the energy ghoul represents. Following the ghoul is a small scouting construct created by the builder. The moment we engage with the ghoul, the builder will know.
It seems that you were right about one thing, Clive, Humphrey said. The builder is using this thing to flush us out.
That makes sense, Neil said. If you have it laying about, why not throw it at us? It's kind of wasting a soul-sucking monster, otherwise.
It's not an actual monster, Clive said. And it doesn't actually suck souls. It would if it could, but souls are inviolable. You can't just crack them like a breakfast egg. No one is going to open themselves up to an energy ghoul, which is for the best, given the result.
The result of what? Humphrey asked.
Well, if it actually managed to consume a soul, it would transform into a soul vampire. Much more powerful, much more dangerous. We don't have to worry about that, though.
Why not? Neil asked.
I told you, souls are inviolable, Clive said. It's not like there's an unattended soul just laying about for it to eat. Why are you all staring at me?
An unattended soul? Neil said.
Exactly, Clive said. Where would it possibly find one of those?
About 8 kilometers away? Jason said.
What? Clive asked.
The one wrapped around the sword, remember? Neil asked. Clive's eyes went wide, and he leapt out of his chair.
Oh, that's bad, he said. That's really, really bad. We can't let that happen, especially not a soul that powerful.
He started pacing back and forth.
Maybe it's fine, Clive said. Maybe whatever's been done to that soul will make it intolerable to the ghoul. It'll just ignore it.
Right now, the ghoul is moving in almost a straight line in the direction of the location you are discussing, Shade said. So long as you leave in the next several minutes, you will be able to comfortably intercept the ghoul.
Why didn't you say that before? Clive asked Shade wildly.
I largely avoid embroiling myself in the affairs of the great astral beings, Shade said. My affiliation with the Reaper tends to cause complications. As such, I am unfamiliar with the specifics around taking mortal vessels and their subsequent condition.
Then we need to move, Humphrey said. I can only imagine that letting the ghoul consume that soul is trouble enough, let alone unleashing the sword it imprisons.
Double the trouble, Jason said.
Are we sure this whole thing isn't a trap?
Sophie asked.
Does the Builder know about the sword and is baiting us into trying to stop the ghoul?
Doesn't matter, Clive said. We have to stop it even if we know for certain it's a trap. A soul that powerful might even let the ghoul rise up to a gold rank soul vampire. If that happens, I don't see us leaving this place alive, let alone stopping the Builder.
The Builder, Zato and Timos, were preparing to exit the walled fortress with an assembled group of cultists, constructs, and converted purity priests.
You have a concern, Timos?
The Builder asked.
I don't feel it's appropriate to say, Lord Builder.
Speak, Timos.
It's just that face, Timos said. I spent more time than I would care to holding Thadwick Mercer's leash. It's still a little odd seeing his face without his unique mix of vacuousness, insecurity, and disdain.
I always find obtaining the memories of a vessel to be interesting, the Builder said. Very few things are difficult to a transcendent being, but obtaining a mortal perspective is one of them. It makes predicting mortal behavior difficult. So often you make choices that objectively work against your own interests or are even self-destructive.
If that's what you're looking for, I don't think you could have found a better vessel, Timos said. Thadwick Mercer was a disaster of self-sabotage.
Indeed, the Builder said. I was hoping for some insight into the Rejector, but this vessel was so self-deluded that I don't entirely trust the memories.
The Builder tilted its head, as if listening to something.
The ghoul is moving with speed and purpose, it said. It has been attracted to something.
The Rejector's team, Timos said. Perhaps they were nearby, scouting the fortress.
I'll take some of our forces and capture them, Zato said.
No, the Builder said. Rushing to the attack is what cost us Hendren, but there is no benefit in losing you. Send a force of converted and constructs under the command of one of the Bronze Rankers.
I'll arrange it, Lord, but I am uncertain they will find success against a group that already defeated a Silver Ranker.
They will not, the Builder said. That is not the purpose of sending them. The mobility of being a small group is their key advantage against us. Rushing out to attack each time we catch wind of them only plays to that strength. One of our advantages is in numbers, and it is time to make use of them.
Please enlighten me, Lord, Zato said.
I will send observers with this force. We shall see how the Rejector and his team fight them, that we might develop countermeasures for future encounters. All it will cost us is a small portion of our superior numbers.
Planting the seeds of victory in the soil of defeat, my lord is wise and long-sighted.
Don't be a sycophant, Zato. I am not a god, in need of fawning worshippers.
Apologies, Lord Builder.
Since the leap in Jason's aura power after his encounter with the Builder's starseed, Jason had been engaging the team in anti-suppression training.
He couldn't raise the strength of their aura, but they could train to make the most of the strength they had. By keeping their aura projection uniform and resolute, they would present no weakness for the ghoul's aura to pounce on and collapse their auras entirely, leaving them exposed to its feeding ability. This paid off when they encountered the ghoul, who immediately let out a soul-piercing shriek to go with its soul-suppressing aura. Aside from Jason, the team were all staggered, but not debilitated. Jason himself plunged forward, undaunted. The encounter happened in amongst tightly packed buildings, the jungle overgrowth turning narrow streets into cramped canyons. Vines covered the walls, and trees on the rooftops formed a canopy that stretched over the streets and cast everything in shadow. The ghoul was a ragged, wretched thing, its clothes torn and bloody. Even though it was more intact than when Jason had seen it as the builder's vessel, he saw even less of the man he remembered. Dougal had been the one to capture him in what felt like a lifetime ago back at the Vayne Estate. It had only been just a few months more than a year ago, but Jason was literally and figuratively transformed. Then he had been scared and confused, halfway to madness and not entirely certain he wasn't the whole way there. Scrambling to survive, let alone understand what was happening to him, the repeated hits to the head with a shovel did not help. The man who had been holding that shovel had undergone an even greater transformation than Jason, although not for the better. A less than pleasant man in life, undeath had rendered him into an even more unpleasant monstrosity. The ghoul was silver rank, but without the power to penetrate Jason's aura, it was no more threat than its silver rank attributes, themselves on the lower end of the scale. It fought unthinkingly and without skill, while the environment was a playground for Jason's abilities. His affliction powers were able to shine against the creature's silver rank fortitude, hardy enough to withstand far more punishment than any bronze ranker. The escalating nature of Jason's afflictions proved their worth as they inevitably overwhelmed the ghoul. With the enclosed space and the team concentrating on fending off the ghoul's aura, they had not detected the presence of the builder's forces until they were almost upon them. Even as Jason's execute was annihilating the ghoul, the team heard the approach of the clunky stone constructs. Chapter 63. War of Adaptation. The enemy force only had a few cultists, being mostly made up of constructs and the converted. They hadn't even engaged Jason's team before being thrown into confusion as Belinda used her unexpected ally spell. The team were masked in illusions that made them appear as members of the enemy force. Illusionary doubles of their true form appeared as allies and enemies alike were switch-teleported around the area by Belinda's spell. The enemy constructs were unthinking automatons, and the converted former clergy weren't much better. Neither handled the confusing shift in the battlefield well. When the team attacked them under the disguise of illusion, they retaliated against what appeared to be members of their own force. The illusionary disguises weren't very good, and most of the team was easy to pick out. Humphrey, for example, had taken the form of one of the blank face converted, but was still wielding his huge dragon sword. The mindless enemy, however, was easily deceived. Once they thought their own forces were attacking them, things got very messy very fast. The cultists commanding the forces worked to get things back under control as their forces started fighting one another. It helped that the illusions did not last long, and their enemies once again became clear. Jason and his team had used that window of confusion to maximum effect. The team was well practiced in handling the chaos of Belinda's power, and had used the moment of confusion to set themselves up for the fight against an enemy in disarray. The priority was getting the team's backline out of harm's way, Sophie and Humphrey immediately moving to clear paths for Clive and Neil to escape the fray. Belinda activated her counterfeit champion power, equipped some hefty equipment, and extracted herself. After the random switch teleport by Belinda, Jason had found himself in the midst of constructs. They ranged from larger than him to much larger than him, in a myriad of monstrous forms. Rather than wasting the precious moments of enemy confusion looking for more fleshy opponents, he drew his sword and put his recent training into practice. Shade's bodies spread out between them, giving Jason plenty of flexibility for shadow teleports, and he made the most of them. He moved amongst the constructs like a ghost, his sword dancing to make rapid-fire hits in staccato rhythm. With the aid of Sophie and Humphrey, Clive and Neil extricated themselves from the scrum, heading for the reliable presence of Onslow, who had been unconvincingly disguised as one of the larger constructs. Neil's burst shield proved especially effective in getting them clear. Ability, burst shield, shield. Special ability, healing, recovery. Cost, moderate mana. Cooldown, 20 seconds. Current rank, bronze, 3, 87%. Effect, iron. Create a short-lived shield that negates an incoming attack and explodes out, knocking back nearby enemies and inflicting concussive damage. High damage attacks of silver rank or higher may not be entirely negated. Effect, bronze, inflicts vibrant echo on anyone damaged by the blast. Vibrant echo, affliction, damage over time, magic, inflicts ongoing resonating force damage. The enemy started getting back into order, the converted pooling into one group and the constructs into another, with the few ordinary cultists at the back. Sophie moved against the concentration of converted, the blank-faced former clergy, all fighting back in an eerily identical manner. They had the same strength, the same speed, the same technique, all used in the same way. They fought with the same emotionless expression. The converted were fast and skilled, moving in a manner that was rigid, yet swift and efficient. They didn't have weapons, but their bones were hard as steel, their knuckles, knees, and elbows making effective bludgeons. They used those weapons startlingly well for clergy, all fighting with the same expertise and identical technique. The converted had the technique of someone who had learned it from a skill book without ever attempting to make those techniques their own. The skill was undoubtedly present, but they fought without creativity or initiative. They were slaves to the patterns, with neither innovation nor imagination on display. It did not take long for Sophie to see through the patterns and start exploiting them. If they weren't up against Sophie, the efficient, robotic movements of the converted might have seemed like a precision machine. Instead, they came across as the crude prototype of her finished product. Even compared to their programmed uniform efficiency, Sophie was faster, cleaner, and even more economical of motion. Every motion was smooth, not so much as a gesture wasted, as every action flowed into the next. She danced through her opponents, as if the whole fight had been choreographed, but she was the only one who knew. Sophie moved swiftly, holding the attention of as many of the converted as she could while they attempted to overrun her. What they lacked in imagination, they made up for in sheer numbers. Their fortitude and regenerative power meant that she couldn't take any of them out completely, forced to perpetually hold them off as they kept coming in a relentless tide. Even with her skill, Sophie could not have handled the numbers without support. Clive and Neil threw spells on her, with Neil's burst shield spell regularly clearing space and buying her critical breathing room. Having seen Neil and Clive regroup at the rear and join up with Belinda, Humphrey went for the cultists commanding the force. There were only three bronze rankers, mediocre cultists that were no match for Humphrey, even 3-on-1. They were sent staggering by his fire breath, before quickly falling to his sword. Ability, fire breath, dragon, special attack. Cost, very high mana. Cooldown, 50 seconds. Current rank, bronze, 3, 65%. Effect, iron. Breathe a stream of fire that lasts several seconds. Effect, bronze. Anyone damaged by the flames suffers ongoing fire damage. Frowning at the suspicious ease with which they were taken down, he surveyed the battlefield, looking for what he was missing. He spotted a number of strange glass eyes, held off the ground on spider legs, watching the fight. When he went after them, they skidded away before he could close the distance. In the jungle confines, there was plenty of space to hide, and though he could sense their magic, he didn't have time to go digging them out. Humphrey, Jason said through voice chat. I could use an assist. Jason was oddly thriving amongst the constructs. They were large and tough, hulking stone forms in the shape of various strange monsters. The constructs were milling about like a bunch of people trying to stomp out a scurrying bug, but their intimidating and bulky forms didn't help them pin down the shadowy figure flittering in their midst. Jason was ever on the move, his sword ringing out on the stone in a rat-a-tat pattern. His sword had built up enough power that chunks of stone were flying off with every strike. Although Jason's efforts were going well, that did not make them easy. The biggest problem was the lone silver rank construct amongst the otherwise bronze ranker group. It was faster than the others, and tough enough that Jason's sword was yet to pick up enough power to damage it effectively. Unlike Jason himself, his sword did not have the ability to overcome silver rank resistances. Although no smarter than the others, the silver rank construct remained a constant threat that Jason had to continuously work around. If he had been fighting it alone, he could have handled it, but on top of the others, it was pressuring his ability to remain evasive. The intercession of Humphrey changed that significantly. Like taking a sledgehammer to a condemned building, he laid into it with workmanlike special attacks, breaking it apart in huge chunks. "You want to go help Sophie and leave this lot to me?" Humphrey asked as the silver rank construct collapsed. "I could use the practice," Jason said. "You go." In the midst of the converted, Sophie was ramping up. They had been slowly overwhelming her from the beginning. Their numbers and near indestructibility made it like trying to fight back the tide. Even Sophie's skill was not enough to go unscathed against so many attackers. But she was realizing that taking a few hits was not so bad, as long as she wasn't staggered and pinned down. With every hit, her karmic warrior ability increased her power, allowing her to hold up all the better. Humphrey joined in, but even his destructive power was hard-pressed to take down the converted. Their flesh wasn't as tough as the stone constructs, but their bones were harder than metal. It turned out, as Humphrey learned when he tore them apart with special attacks, that metal was indeed laced through their skeletons in thick wires. Worse, those wires could even snake out to reconnect, pulling dismembered body parts back together as their rapid healing knitted the flesh back into place. The converted only presented a limited danger individually, but they were too dangerous to ignore, and their ability to rapidly recover from what should have been catastrophically lethal injury meant that they just kept coming. Only by entirely pulverizing the bulk of their bodies with his special attacks could even Humphrey put an end to them. But he had special attacks to spare. Without the cultists guiding them, the team entered a mop-up phase as they cleared the battlefield. "I wouldn't call this easy exactly," Jason said, once they were done. "But did anyone find this suspiciously lacking in challenge?"
"I believe the purpose is to test us," Shade said. "Rather than any of his more capable people, this group was accompanied by the Builder's Observer constructs."
"You mean those spider eye things?" Humphrey asked. "I spotted those but couldn't catch any of them."
"These things?"
Sophie asked, holding one up by the leg.
"They seem harmless, so they're probably just for watching us."
The main body was an oversized crystal eye, around half the size of a fist. Legs came out from the sides like those of a spider, made of a smoky quartz stone. Jason moved closer, peering into it.
"You in there, mate?"
Jason asked.
"You and I weren't exactly being honest with one another the last time we met. You were stalling to try and find me. I was baiting your hench people into a trap.
I'm not saying I won, but you're down a silver ranker and I'm up a nice personal grooming set he had on him. Keeps the beard nice and trim, you know?"
"Jason, what are you doing?"
Sophie asked.
"I'm talking to my mate Bill," Jason said. "Just keep holding up the thing."
"Sorry about that, Bill. That's the problem when you lease your slaves. The moment the lease runs out, they get all mouthy."
"Hey."
"Shush you. Anyway, Bill, I'm not completely on board with this whole probing attack scenario. I've made a career out of taking on the kind of self-destructive idiots whose bad choices are more of a danger to themselves than I ever was. That's the kind of enemy that's in my wheelhouse. So if you could go ahead and make a rash decision that sows the seeds of your own downfall, that'd really help me out."
"Jason,"
Humphrey said. "Sorry, Bill, they're playing me off. Got to go.
But you keep an eye out. Rumor is that there's some lunatic super god running around.